But after a while, I started to see this thing called the internet gradually encroach and grow. And I decided I'd like to just dive right into that. So that's when I left APTN and decided to set up this thing, Media Indigena. I mean, it didn't happen right away, but that was what was driving me. And MediaIndigena.com, this, like, Media Indigena wasn't a podcast in the beginning. It was meant to be kind of a group blog, almost like a magazine. So I recruited a bunch of folks like Negan Sinclair, Wapkishik Rice, Tim Fontaine, Dan David, Martha Troyan, on and on. So so the idea, I guess, was if we all contributed one piece a week, you know, there'd be 10 pieces every week. And so, you know, that went a certain distance. And, I mean, all these people I spoke to, they were all successful in their own right. That's why I recorded them. That's why I recruited them, rather. And they got increasingly busy. And so it was an interesting experiment at the time, but it did set the stage for what came later, which was the podcast.
Quay, Nene DeLuise, Pam Palmiter, and I'm the host of this show, The Warrior Life. I'm a lawyer, professor, author, and activist from Eel River Bar First Nation, and my motto is education for action on Indigenous rights, social justice, and protecting the planet. On this podcast, you're going to get an education of a different kind, one that's enriched by the cultures, insights, and experiences of Indigenous authors, artists, musicians, and academics, as well as leaders and activists, land defenders, and water protectors, all of whom are on the front lines of Indigenous resistance, resurgence, and revitalization. And today's podcast is going to be a fun one. I actually get to do a podcast interview with the greatest Indigenous podcaster of all time. And so that means the pressure is on. So stay tuned. Welcome back to the Warrior Life Podcast. I'm your host, Pam Palmiter. And today I get to talk to podcaster extraordinaire, maybe you could call him GOAT, greatest of all time, Rick Harp. Welcome to my podcast, Rick.
I can't possibly live up to that kind of intro, but hey, how's it going, Pam?
It's going awesome. I'm just so excited that I finally get to talk to you because you were literally on the podcast trend before I even knew what a podcast was. Honestly, wow. It was well after being on your podcast that I knew, hey, wait, this is not just for the news. This is legit a podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how 8 years ago, this was 2016, I'll get it right. Yeah, 8 years ago, holy smokes, that we embarked upon this. And the time has gone fast. It's 300 and, gosh, we're nearing 350 episodes. Amazing.
Yeah.
It just all melts into one big blob. But at the same time, I've definitely had some memorable moments, and it's definitely transformed my life. And I've met some great people as a result, and I think it provides value to the listenership, because a good chunk of them contribute to it through my Patreon every month. So just grateful for the opportunity, and it's just been an amazing experience overall in terms of learning and growing.
Well, I loved it. So when you first invited me to be a panelist with Media Indigena, I think I was paired with Paul Sisaquasis, the Cree artist guy.
Right.
And I just remember, like, so you can imagine me, this hot-headed, like, political commentator, you, the smooth, debonair host, and then Paul, this soft, quiet voice artist, and all three of us talking about political issues. It was a hoot.
Yeah, no, that's going back once again. Yeah, no, I loved it. No, it's so straightforward and yet so powerful that, you know, you were in Ontario. Paul, I think, was he in BC or Saskatchewan? And I was in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And thanks to the interweb, we were able to have a real-time conversation and then slightly edited in the final presentation. to discourse on the issues that we saw fit to discourse about, but through our lens. And it was a wonderful, fruitful exchange.
Well, and so, Rick, just for the listeners, in case there's someone on a different planet who hasn't actually heard of Media Indigena, this isn't being produced by CBC or Canada Land or APTN. This is your own project, right?
That's correct. It is a byproduct of the parent company that is essentially me and one other person, the Indigena Creative Group. And this was, you know, when I started it, it was still kind of fledgling, the idea of doing a podcast, much less making a living off of it. And it was just sort of an itch I wanted to scratch, because I, you know, kind of probably frustrated everybody, not to mention myself, around me, talking about, I should do this. And to be frank, I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to fail miserably by any metric you can imagine. And then I can move on with my life. You know what I mean? It's kind of like some hobby or whatever, you know, pastime somebody just keeps talking about, and you're like, can you just do it already so we can have you talk about something else? And, you know, to my surprise, it caught on. And you know, initially, most of the gains were personal, were learning about this new realm, which was similar to radio, but different. At the same time, audio is audio. And although they do have their specific manifestations in each realm, audio was at the heart of it. And so I was able to take my experience in broadcasting and put it into podcasting. And as the cliche goes, haven't looked back since.
And here I am. You're like, oh, come on my show. And I'm just thinking, oh, it's a radio show. What do I know about podcasts? You know, my experience in media was not like yours. It was trial by fire, being interviewed as opposed to being the interviewee. So how on earth did you even think about podcasts? Because you have this massive, like, experience in the media, communications, in broadcasting. You've had on-air roles at CBC, at APTN, the Aboriginal People's Television Network. You were the former, you know, artistic director at Winnipeg Aboriginal Film Festival. Like, you've been kicking ass and taking names for decades. What made you say, oh, I think I've heard of something called a podcast, let me do that?
Let me just take a step back there and absorb all that you've just said. You know, I guess on one level, again, it was a familiar medium, only transmitted through an incredibly powerful, yet, you know, deceptively simple yet powerful means of distribution. You know, a podcast, for those who don't know, is, I mean, it's essentially just an MP3 that you upload to a website that then takes care of the distribution to all the various podcast players. You know, it's all meant to be as seamless as possible, but there's actually some cool stuff going on in the background. And I just thought, this, how can nobody else see how amazing this truly is to be able to do this? Whereas before, you know, there were a lot of gatekeepers, and it was just too expensive to even contemplate something of this order. And podcasting, again, you know, anybody can do it, quote unquote, but in some ways that's its problem. There's tens of thousands of podcasts, some of which barely last, you know, 10 episodes. And, you know, that used to be described as, you know, pod fading, the cutoff, and people go, man, this is harder than I thought. Yes, it's always harder than you think. And so, but at the same time, I could be a one person, you know, media creation house. And so it was. And I think that's what brought me into it, was just the ability to do something by myself. Now, of course, I bring in other people into this virtual space, so to speak. And I decided upon, you know, I liked various sort of roundtables and panels, political panels in the mainstream. But I thought they always, you know, they rarely do justice, if ever, when it comes to Indigenous issues, and it's usually through a non-Indigenous perspective, right? And I thought, what would an Indigenous-led, Indigenous-driven podcast sound like? And so, you know, coupled again with this sort of like itch that I wanted to scratch, thinking, well, it could be a scratch and win, or I could scratch till I bleed, you know, but it was low risk, right? It was low risk and low cost, frankly. The cost of entry, I think, in some ways, ultimately determined why I took upon trying this, because, you know, it's $20 a month to get one of these websites to host your and then distribute your file. I use Libsyn, short for Liberated Syndication. Just love it. It's I've used it ever since I started back in 2016. And, you know, technological familiarity you have to go through, but nothing more difficult than, let's say, learning how to operate a motor vehicle, which, you know, can do a lot of damage, frankly. But so much less risk. And why not try it out? It just seemed like a natural extension and exploration of what I had done up to that point.
Well, and I want to talk to you about what you've done up until that point, because I feel like I'm doing you an injustice if we only talk about like the greatest of all time media indigenous podcast, because you literally have decades in the media. And I kind of want to back up from there, because when I was reading your bio online, it says that you originally were studying politics at Carleton University, and that you caught the media bug, I guess, from the community radio station. It made me think, wait a second, how close was Canada to having a chief harp, or maybe prime minister harp? Was that, were you in politics for that reason? Well, were you thinking politics?
I was. I was, you know, perhaps not as conversant with the compromise and the backroom machinations of mainstream politics as I am now, all relatively speaking, of course. And so I started off in fine arts, actually. I thought I was going to be, you know, a cartoonist, do comic books and stuff like this. And the first year kind of really disabused me of whether I could, you know, last in fine arts as a faculty. Let me make that distinction clear. I mean, I love to draw, I love to illustrate. I had an artistic bent and, you know, went through the whole rigmarole of applying and putting a portfolio together, and then actually got into fine arts and was just like, this is not for me. And one of my instructors actually said to me, I think you should really think about why you're in this educational field.
And
I took it as a diss, and it was kind of a diss, but in a way that individual kind of did me a favor, because it's an important question, right? Like, why are you doing what you're doing? Are you doing it for you? Do you understand the demands? Do you understand, I guess you could call it the politics, but so I then bounced out of there and then started taking other courses. And one of the ones that the two of the ones that had the most, I think, enduring impact on me were Intro to Native Studies with Emma LaRocque and an Intro to Politics class. And to my surprise, I did really well in them, and I did really well in a Introduction to Logic course. And so then I was asked by a friend if I wanted to go to Australia for an extended trip. At this point, I had put a pause on my education. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do next. So in a way, I kind of got all my electives out of the way for an undergrad degree. Go to Australia, intent on learning what little I could in that short span of time, is about 2.5 months, about Indigenous peoples there. And I guess I just came away from it just kind of charged up thinking, maybe I didn't want to get into politics. So I thought, where should I go? I was going to University of Manitoba at the time, so I applied to Queen's, York, and Carleton. Queen's, you know, you could hear them laughing at my application from hundreds of kilometers away. No. I didn't have stellar grades, yeah. And so York accepted me first, and then Carleton accepted me. And I just thought, Ottawa's smaller, Toronto seems big. And so I went to Carleton, and I got a poli-sci degree in the end, but I'll be honest, like, it was the student newspaper and the campus-based community radio station, CKCU-FM, which is the oldest station of its kind in Canada, which really, I think, lit a fire in me in terms of getting into media. It community radio, I cannot speak highly enough of. It's just a great opportunity, still is, frankly, even in this age of podcasting. And I know a lot of community stations have actually pivoted to include podcasting as part of its ambit. So I got a little involved, not formally, but just on the outer edges of student politics, and that made me very cynical about politics in general. And then as I learned more and more about what it takes to get anywhere in mainstream politics, that made me think, in combination with the fact that I was getting so much out of, media making myself, in some ways, it's not like I've walked away from politics. I just channel my energies in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, not everybody's path is straight. In fact, I know very few people who've, from the time I was 3, I knew I was going to do this. And then they have this one little path, and that's how it goes. But, I'm still wondering, okay, I get the mainstream politics not being, appealing, but chief and council politics, you had no attraction to that?
No. I mean, I know some amazing people who have been involved in that realm, that jurisdiction of politics. And I just, I think I'd kind of drifted away into, I was, as you noted, I was bit by the radio bug pretty hard and had no interest, no eye or ear for anything else.
Well, I mean, there you go. And you're from Peter Ballantyne First Nation, right?
Peter Ballantyne Cree Nation in Northern Saskatchewan. It's composed of multiple communities, one of which is South End, and that's where my mom is from, the South End of Reindeer Lake.
Oh.
She, unfortunately, to put it mildly, was taken into residential schools, three of them, at various points in her life. And that put her on a path that saw her end up in Winnipeg, and that's where she had me. And so I'm a quote unquote born and bred Winnipegger, and spent most of my early life there, and then somehow ended up back here. I went to Ottawa, obviously Ottawa Carleton, and spent a year in Toronto. I've bounced around a little bit. I've called a few places home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you think about it, Winnipeg's like, isn't it the coolest native reserve in all of Canada, effectively?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I think so, but I don't know if your average settler Winnipegger would, but be that as it may.
Yeah, be that as it may. Okay, well then, the preceding question to that then is, you were a little kid, what did you want to be? Like, did you think, I want to be a superhero, I want to be a paramedic, I want to be, on Dan Rather on the news.
Well, I wanted to draw superheroes, it was a real mismatch, right? Like for me going into fine arts, I wanted to go to Red River College, which, had a program where you were there just to learn the sort of technical side. I was encouraged by a high school teacher to actually know you should get a university degree to fall back on. Very grateful to that. He was my fine arts teacher at high school in Winnipeg. Shout out to Kelvin, if that has any resonance for anybody. actually, my daughter went there not so long ago. So there's a trip. Anyway, I definitely wanted to draw for Marvel or maybe DC. I don't know. Anyway, let's not get into that debate. But at the same time, my friends and I got really enamored with a cassette recorder. We're talking cassettes, and B, we're talking one of these old clunky, kind of rectangles, which allow you to make your own audio, not necessarily all that great. Had a built-in condenser microphone. And we started to do all these skits. We just had lots of fun. So we'd play with the audio, and sometimes I'd get another recorder, that way we could do background effects. and it was, my goodness, I think that's what sowed the seed for me in terms of ending up in audio, is because I was in my own little world or whatever, I was co-creating this little audio world. I was world building. And I think that that set the stage ultimately for my interest in the arts generally, in communication generally. So, although it's funny, I wasn't career minded with that. That was just pure play. And that was something, something quite amazing about that, to be honest. It, you know, sometimes I wonder about, you know, do a job you love and you never work a day in your life, but there's all sorts of memes out there saying, no, you'll come to resent it like any other job.
Oh, no.
But, you know, I'm sure there's some days you're like, oh, what am I going to do this week? I know. I'll call up Harp again. No. but so, you know, you almost become like enslaved to this incessant schedule. But in any case, I feel fortunate actually to be able to kind of just forge a path in this kind of circuitous way. I mean, mm-hmm. I know there's lots of people who, you know, at career day or whatever, suggest that it should be, you know, this linear straight line. But if you're allowed to explore, you'll still get somewhere eventually. And there's nothing wasted, right? There's nothing irrelevant to your ultimate destination, quote unquote. Everything you've gone through, you can draw on. Anyway, here I am sounding like one of those role models I don't like. But anyway.
No, it's so true. And I'm just so fascinated. I always ask people on this podcast, what did you want to do when you were a kid? Or what were you doing when you were a kid? Because for me, I didn't know what a career was going to be when I was a kid. Like, I wasn't thinking, oh, I want to be a nurse or a teacher or anything. All I knew was that in grade four, my older brother got me a tape recorder for Christmas and a set of batteries and a cassette tape. And I created PAM News.
Nice.
And I went around and I interviewed people and I made commentary and like I listened to songs and it just became a thing. And then I tried to do all my school projects with me being PAM News. And, you know, but then when you grow up and it's like, oh, you got to do something to make a living. And it's like, oh, what am I going to do? Yeah. I better go become a lawyer. I better go do this. I better go do that. But isn't that funny how your brain makes you come right back around to what it is that you, I don't know, that inspires you or makes you happy?
Do you have any of those cassettes?
Oh, I do.
PAM News? You do?
Rick, I was traumatized that, you know, over the years, because back in the day, people didn't keep stuff. So my mom would throw out everything, like every toy I ever had. And so I was always heartbroken because I must have had 20 of those cassettes of like, maybe 2 or 3 years worth of me just nonstop jibber jabbering. And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to put it out into the universe. I'm just going to say, okay, you know what? One of these days, I'm going to come across one of my cassettes and I'm going to very carefully take it somewhere so they can put it on digital so that I have it and the tape doesn't disintegrate. And sure enough, my house had to have major repairs. So I had to move everything out. And when I was moving back in, out falls this little cassette and it's PAM News. It's so cute.
Okay. Yeah. That's one of my regrets is that I didn't keep those cassettes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that it just makes me wonder how people come back around to things without them purposely thinking about it.
Yeah.
And there's you. So you're in this amazing world of university where people end up doing amazing things, your school newspaper, community radio. How did you go from that to CBC and APTN?
I can go on at length about this, but basically the shorter version is there was an internship underwritten by what is now called Inspire. Trying to remember what it was called before. John Kimbell was still there. Anyway, they partnered up with a radio program called As It Happens, and they were having a special 8-month internship at As It Happens. And so, to be honest, I wasn't 100% sure what As It Happens was. I had a vague idea, and I started talking to other people. You know, I fraternized with some people in the journalism program at Carleton. Mm-hmm. And they just said, yeah, that's a big deal. You should go for that. Oh, okay. So I applied and to my surprise, I actually got in. And so that's where I really kind of cut my teeth in terms of being able to, you know, push out a story within less than a day. People may not realize it, but it takes a lot to start from zero practically and turn out a 6-minute interview that's going to appear on national radio that evening. And, you know, if you got two out, you were seen as a superstar. So I did that for a while. It was trial by fire, sink or swim. I came to really resent it, frankly, in the beginning, but I look back on it now and think, you know, it enabled me ultimately to do what I do now. I mean, now I almost have to hold myself back. I will tend to kind of go deep into the dark forest, become a stranger to everyone around me as I become obsessed about a project. But so it's sort of a hate love thing about that tendency that was, you know, nurtured by CBC anyway. And then, so that was about a year, and then the internship dollars ran out. And so I ended up back. So that was in Toronto at CBC headquarters.
Oh.
And I discovered the opportunity to do the internship in Ottawa. So I moved back to Ottawa and got back involved with the community radio station for a while. Did a communications gig to pay the bills at the Canadian Human Rights Commission. And then I ended up on, before that I was on staff with CKCU. That's the name of the radio station, if I haven't mentioned it already. And then all of a sudden I see this job posting for a whole slew of jobs at APTN for a fledgling newscast. And so I wasn't sure about where my skill set was at in terms of how attractive it may or may not be. Again, you got to keep in mind, I was just not doing a lot of on-air stuff at this point. I co-hosted a morning show once a week, called Special Blend. Anyway, I applied for the job, and not only do I get a role, they actually upgraded this because I had done a demo tape, and they asked me, have you ever thought about hosting? And because I had applied for a writer researcher job, kind of wanting to aim right where I felt I should have aimed as opposed to being too ambitious. And I was like, I would do it if you want me to. and so yeah, they hadn't advertised my first big gig with APTN, which was a show called Contact, which was a live national phone-in program. So much in the, you know, vein of CBC Radio's cross-country checkup. So I just went with it, and it turned out reasonably well, I think. And did that for about 5 years. So I was with APTN in its very beginnings, and I'm very proud of that. But after a while, I started to see this thing called the internet gradually encroach and grow. And I decided I'd like to just dive right into that. So that's when I left APTN and decided to set up this thing, Media Indigena. I mean, it didn't happen right away, but that was what was driving me. And MediaIndigena.com, Media Indigena wasn't a podcast in the beginning. It was meant to be kind of a group blog, almost like a magazine. So I recruited a bunch of folks like Negan Sinclair, Wapkishik Rice, Tim Fontaine, Dan David, Martha Troyan, on and on. So so the idea, I guess, was if we all contributed one piece a week, you know, there'd be 10 pieces every week. And so, you know, that went a certain distance. And then, you know, as these things go, indie media outlets, you know, you sort of struggle to figure out how to make money, the business model kind of thing. And other people started to, I mean, all these people I spoke to, they were all successful in their own right. That's why I recruited them. That's why I recruited them, rather. And they got increasingly busy. And so it was an interesting experiment at the time, but it did set the stage for what came later, which was the podcast. I did a stint at Streets FM, which was an Indigenous hip hop station in Winnipeg. I think there might have been or may still be one in Australia, but I've not heard of any such station. It doesn't exist anymore. It was a grand experiment that didn't quite last. But anyway, they asked me to do a current affairs show there. So I did something called Urban Nation Live. And so that was aimed at youth. It was trying to take sort of a journalistic approach to hip hop and try and get people interested in the themes of hip hop, which, you know, in its origins was very much concerned with Black empowerment. It's eventually become something else. I'll leave that for others to judge what it's become, but it seems to have, you know, moved far away from that kind of consciousness, revolutionary consciousness that at least informed performers like Public Enemy. Anyway, so it was while I was there that my name was passed on to somebody at CBC Radio in Edmonton, and they recruited me to be their morning show host. And that lasted. That was a hoot. I did that for about 20 months, and then I was let go. I was told, what was it? Not a good fit. There you go.
No. So
it's all good. And, but there too, I mean, once again, CBC, putting me through the ringer. I mean, the pace of a morning show is intense. Mm. But again, if as it happens, cut my teeth, CBC Edmonton sharpened them. And so it proved that I could turn out content again on a fairly quick clip, and taught me a lot about format, what I like, what I didn't like. Anyway, so I ended up back in Winnipeg and did communications for a while for the National Collaborating Center for Infectious Diseases. And it was around that time that I'm like, hey, there's this podcasting thing. What's that about? And I mean, I was aware of it. I mean, I don't want to pretend it just came to me after CBC, but CBC at that time was not really invested in it. I think they were pretty tentative about it. They weren't certain. I mean, my goodness, they've really gone all in now. But at the time, I was told that, you know, by the person who eventually fired me, that podcasts are going nowhere.
I was like, Oh yeah.
Oh, and I was just dumbfounded. So I didn't know what to say. Anyway, that's around 2016 is when I started to delve into it. And here we are 8 years later.
I know. And it's so amazing. I couldn't believe when I looked up to see how many podcasts you had done. And I was like, this guy's like over 350 podcasts. That's as a podcaster and the amount of work I put into podcasting, it made me tired to look at that number. I felt very fatigued.
Indeed. Oh, it's one of those things. Don't look up. Just look at what's in front of you. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes it's an accomplishment just to get the episode out the door, regardless of the quality of it. Other times, I'm just absolutely super proud of what we managed to achieve. And I mean, that's the nature of media, somewhat ephemeral. Although on the other hand, I mean, there is this archive, right, of nearly 350 episodes, which there was this one fan, shall we say, who took it upon themselves as their mission to listen to, because they had come late to the party, as it were. I think they came across it in its fifth season or whatever. Took it upon himself to listen to every single episode, and then turned around and gave me X dollars per episode as one total pledge. So isn't that something? So that's when you realize, oh my goodness, people, it's not just a number. This had an impact on folks, and to the point where they want to support it financially, which has always been a real trip for me. The fact that someone would dig into their pocket and subscribe basically to the show on a monthly basis. So that's what Patreon is. It's essentially kind of a glorified payment processor that takes a certain amount out of somebody's credit card account once a month, and in support of your show. And they take their little cut, and then you get the rest. And you know, it's not generated a full-time job for me, but I would certainly say it's put food on my family's table and enabled me to do things that I couldn't otherwise. And
and you've made history. You like literally when I think about, so you think about radio shows, right? And you know, you could have a radio show that goes on for 20 years. And if you were lucky to be a regular listener and you didn't have a crazy life like I did, you know, you could listen, you could catch some good shows over the years. But with podcasts, it's documented. You've got history. And I don't know about any other genre. Maybe this is not the same for cooks or comedians, but for Native people, to have our voices there for eternity, to have things documented in history, what was going on that day, what was going on in that year, what were we thinking about it? Like, you have the massive, it's effectively this massive historical encyclopedia of us and our issues. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, no, it's true. When you look at it that way, I mean, it's this archive, and it's, yeah, what were people thinking? What was their immediate reaction to things? And sometimes we revisit topics. So, and sometimes they even become compiled. In the summer series we do to, I'd like to have a little break, you know? So we take old episodes and package them together. And then in some ways you see the chronology of it, see the evolution of a discussion or evolution of events on the ground. Like, for example, I remember us talking about, you know, sexist discrimination in the Indian Act. And so that was part of a larger discussion around belonging. And so it was, I was able to kind of revisit it and update the story. And so that was really fascinating. And like you say, it's a living archive, which is a great way to look at it, I think.
So with your content, do you, are you obsessed about the analytics? Like, do you go behind and say, oh, this show did really well, or this show didn't do so well? Like, do you look at those analytics?
I did. I at one point I really was obsessed with them because I needed some way to justify all this labor and time. But then something happened in the last few years where it became clear that downloads, quote unquote, of people's podcast episodes were like PDFs. And the analogy applies because there's a stat out there in terms of, you know, all the academic PDFs, or perhaps just publications period, not just restricted to academia, of all the all the PDFs out there, a scant tiny percentage gets downloaded. And then of those downloaded, so in other words, put on your computer, a tiny fragment actually gets opened and read. And the challenge is you don't know which were actually opened and consumed. And so podcasts, downloads are kind of similar to that. The people's players would be set to auto download, or if they listen to episode 5 and then listen to episode 100, podcast players were set up to download all the episodes in between. And so that would show up in your statistics as, look at all these downloads. Now, you know, I would watch the trend lines and sort of see it in that light, but to be honest, there were some major changes made. Apple Podcasts is the leading podcast player, and they decided to get rid of all that stuff I just mentioned and to make listens more pure and sort of on a real-time basis. In other words, not a download that you may or may not listen to, but almost like a stream. And I probably got the technical aspects of that, you know, less than you know, 100% accurate. But the general point is, to get a download was a lot more rigorous lately than it was before. And so I've seen a drop in downloads. The one key number that I pay attention to a lot is the number of people who support me on that kind of crowdfunding platform, Patreon. And we were at a high of almost 700. Then COVID happened. Then, you know, this kind of semi-recession we're all living through, or what have you, and probably a whole host of other factors that I just don't have time to delve into, like for my own purposes, I mean, not necessarily here on the show, we've kind of ended up closer to around 515. And but at the same time, like I say, it does provide me a steady source of income. And so that those are that's the number I tend to still fixate on. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, people's ability to pay for this is everyone's hurting, right? Everyone's had to take a hard look at their finances in light of the hits they've taken in their pocketbook. So I don't begrudge anybody coming in, funding it for a few months, and then going away. Some people give one-time contributions, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. I even still get checks every so often.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. And then I'll physically walk it down to the bank. And, I'm old school. I'm an old man. But
Oh, that's cool, Rick. Like, I think about all of those things that I used to get so obsessed about. And then some other podcaster I met said, you know, most people don't download podcasts anymore. They just listen to them like online when they have the time. So that's not going to register as a download. And I was like, what? What's happening here? And then I'm thinking, okay, you know what? I'm just not even going to do that, because then you get too tied up in all of those analytics. And I think, you know, what really matters to me is when I see a noticeably good show. Like, are there any shows that you ever had where, wow, this one just got so much listenership because of the topic or whatever?
So I decided to look at, top 10 all time, quote unquote. And again, with the proviso or the caveat that these numbers are in and of themselves, perhaps not suspect, but take them with a pound of salt. But relatively speaking, I know that our Defund Defined show with Al Jones out of Halifax, in the wake of the report at the HRM Halifax Regional Municipality, where they were, you know, she was part of a panel that was tasked with, like, well, what would defunding the police look like? And that did really well. That's probably the number one episode. We did a episode about some, one in particular, traditional healer was accused of inappropriate behavior. So I think that episode was called Unhealthy Healers. That one did pretty well. And then one that I still don't understand, but maybe because it has some mainstream and some timeliness, I don't know. We had a discussion about this column that was written by a Vancouver Sun regular columnist about whether Indigenous people in Canada get all upset about Thanksgiving the way they do in the U.S. And it was just a hot mess of a column. The non-Indigenous columnist found a couple of Indians who would say what he wanted to hear. And so we just did this kind of line by line takedown of all the embedded premises of that piece. And it is to date the number one most downloaded episode.
Wow.
And another one I really am quite struck by was we have two kinds of programs. You know, one we kind of just call the regular program, Media Indigena, where we, spend up to an hour talking about something, like just really unpacking it, sometimes more, right? And then I wanted to do something that was more of sort of a hot take, just a quick overview, quick pass at things. So we eventually called those mini Indigenas. And the one I really liked was where we drew an analogy, or at least a comparison, between Ukrainian freedom fighters and Indigenous freedom fighters. In other words, land defenders trying to push back against Coastal Gas's pipeline through Wet'suwet'en territory. And we said, you know, these are two groups of people who very much both believe in what they're doing, and they're fighting encroachment that is going to, you know, severely disturb and if not destroy their territories. And so we said, why don't the media talk about these two groups, these fighters for what they believe, in the same tone? And clearly they don't. So that program did really well. Now, did it do really well because the word Ukrainian is in the title? I don't know. So
that's awesome. That's SEO, Rick.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Was it search engine optimization? You got it. So
yeah.
So wow. Yeah, you know, you just, I mean, I do frankly try to get shows that I think, you know, or should I say topics that are timely, that that tap into the zeitgeist. But at the same time, you know, I think we are one of the first indigenous led podcasts to talk about pretendianism. Mm-hmm. And you know, ethnic/identity fraud and so-called. And I you know, you never know how these things work, right? You never know how the discourse happens, mm-hmm. you know, how it takes on new topics or goes in certain directions. But I'd like to think that we've made some kind of contribution. I mean, thanks to the leadership of Kim Tallbear, who definitely, you know, was the first to signal that we should be very concerned about pretendians existentially, as she put it. So
yeah.
it is not some cute, amusing, oh, they're playing Indian type of discussion. It's like this threatens our very existence and our independence as indigenous peoples.
Well, Kim Tallbear, for anyone who doesn't know, she's pretty amazing. I think her and I did a one-on-one episode on pretendians, yeah. And I think that's my highest download or listen to or downloaded, whatever you want to call it, show. I think those tend to be the most popular, obviously, more recently because of that. Yeah. But my question to you is, because I'm thinking about this happening to me, have you ever had a show that is raised the ire of every troll on the planet?
Still waiting for that to happen, and I don't want to jinx us, but I don't know. I mean, why it hasn't happened. I think because, I mean, our program has been accused of being a little arcane and academic, and it's true. We can get into the minutia. I mean, just to use the word minutia, right. Is pompous and whatever. And so at the same time, like I like to have a lot of fun on the show, and I'll often make really bad dad jokes. And so I don't know that we're all that inaccessible. I just think we're kind of a deep niche program that for a lot of people, maybe they just don't have the patience for it. I don't know. I really don't know.
Oh, no. I mean, I love your show. I wouldn't say, like, I've listened to some really, like, academic shows. I was thinking more of, have you ever covered a topic where non-Native haters came out and said, you know, like, for example, if I talk about pipelines or white supremacists or pretendians, all the, like, non-Native haters come out of the woodwork and start, you know, chirping about those issues. I guess it's their feelings are hurt or something. Have you ever had a topic or anything where non-Native people were feeling very hard done by?
No. And I mean, defund defined, you would have thought, you know, somebody would come at us. We did a program called Ottawa Overwhelmed about, you know, the settler led occupation of downtown Ottawa. Oh. Again, I would have thought perhaps some trolling would have happened as a result of that. The only pushback we've gotten are shows where we talk about pretendians. There are people who feel like, you know, they don't like certain individuals who are leading that charge against ethnic fraud, and they feel like it's we've taken an inappropriate colonized approach to you know, ways of determining who belongs and who doesn't, you know, that would be the only time. So but nothing that ever touched, like, no one ever said, for example, how dare you compare, you know, ragtag blockaders in, you know, on some back road in BC with these noble you know, anti-Putin freedom fighters.
Yeah.
You're a joke. You know, no one, you know. So, you know,
Cool.
and I don't want to invite it, but.
No.
Like that discussion wondered. About Thanksgiving was in some ways taking on a troll, but he never trolled us in return. So.
Well, there you go. Okay. So looking back at all of your podcasts, I know you only have 350 or so, but were there any that stood out to you, not in terms of they were the most listened to, but like the most memorable moment, like something that just made you guys all laugh or just always stuck with you forever?
You're really putting me on the spot.
I'm doing it.
There's something I guess called recency bias. But I have to say our latest episode is quite funny. Let me put it this way. There's a category of content that I really quite like, and that's where we kind of tickle our own funny bones and hopefully other people find them funny. Where I'll do something like inject sound effects or whatnot. So we just did an episode about a First Nation in BC becoming the second Indigenous licensed Starbucks in Canada. And so I had a lot of sound effects about, you know, involving coffee, pouring coffee, percolators and sipping and all that stuff. So I like the shows where, you know, if you'll pardon the expression, where we kind of take the piss out of things. And because I think there's a tendency to become too serious. And sometimes I like, you know, and it doesn't always work, frankly, but sometimes I like juxtaposing a real serious discussion with this kind of, you know, out of nowhere comment that I don't know. If pressed to the wall or whatever, in some ways this show, I mean, it has a name. It's involving a lot of different voices, some of them recurring, but at the same time, like this show is a reflection of my sensibility. And so I like to reflect the kind of conversations I have in real life with other Indigenous peoples, which is, you know, it can veer and pivot from really intense to humorous in a heartbeat. And so I would say those programs where we, you know, inject a little fun and have, but you know, I'd say the town halls have always been quite something to do, because you're, you know, the audience is there. And I remember so we did a two-part discussion about cannabis, because you know, cannabis was legalized not so long ago. Who'd have thought that ever happened, right? Anyway, it did happen. And so there was this sort of green rush mentality, I suppose, that you know, Indigenous communities weren't immune, and they thought, oh great, we can get in on the pot bandwagon. And we just kind of decided to take kind of a critical look. And I just remember Tim Fontaine was a guest along with Kim Tallbaron. We had done a live episode, and he, you know, I'll share the clip with you if you like, but he talked about, and I forget how it came up exactly, but there was a newspaper report about some crime, alleged crime.
Well, the other day I saw a police report, because I still follow things journalists follow, and it's the very first time in my life that I've ever seen it say Métis in appearance. And I was like, he took off in a Red River cart. It was obvious. Yeah, no. Your Honor, he was jigging towards his Red River cart.
Your Honor, he had a lovely sash.
Swaking his sash around. His name was Riel. Come on. I mean,
what are the odds, right?
So he's Spanish, you're saying.
And every time I think of that little quip, I just, and the audience just, you know, uproariously reacted. And
oh my gosh, Tim's crazy.
You've had him, on the show?
Oh, I have. Oh, but I threw every bizarre question at him possible to try to stump him, and there was no stumping him. Like, there just wasn't. And he managed to be funny for everything. He reminds me of you. I feel like there's this like core group in Winnipeg of all of you who are doing different things, you know, all in the media sphere, so to speak. And I don't know, you guys all have this funny sense of humor, and sometimes it's serious and sometimes it's dry and sometimes it's dad joke. Like when you were emceeing the Pretendian Symposium for 2 days, right. I was thinking, right. This is such a serious, cranky topic for 2 days. and Rick's up there at the podium telling crazy dad jokes. Some of them I didn't even get, but because I didn't, I was laughing and it was just funny. And you just have this awesome way of infusing some lightheartedness into things that obviously, you know, are pretty serious and have impact, but you're like, okay, just calm down, everyone. Here's a dad joke for everybody.
Well, in some ways, I mean, there's no other way to be. I mean, as one of Kim's favorite phrases is talking about, you know, colonial predicaments. And in some ways, like you've got to, and they're perverse, and sometimes they push us into corners where we do things that, you know, we would rather not do, but almost make this weird sense. And I think that's a perfect space for humor, if only to cope with it. But humor can be quite political. Humor can be a way to kind of disarm people. And I'm not saying every joke lands. I'll be happy with half success ratio. But, Tim and I met, oh my God, at the Saskatchewan Indian Federated College, which is now First Nations University of Canada. And geez, that was in Regina back in 2003 or something. I actually recruited that punk into APTN News. So, and yeah, we became fast friends, and I just treasure any time I get to work with him or hang out with him.
Yeah. He's a hoot. I'd say all of you guys, pretty special bunch. That's for sure. Okay. So I'm going to make you think before we end this show, is going to be the hot topics for 2024? Like it can be topics that were covered in 2023, but what do you still think in the native headlines are going to be big deals?
Well, you know, I've heard rumblings of people wanting to really go hard on the NRTA, the Natural Resources Transfer Act, right? And I mean, you fill in the blanks, but because I only have, you know, I'd like to go deeper on it, but my understanding is at a certain point in the 1900s, Canada just said, hey, Western provinces, how'd you like dominion over resources officially? And didn't consult First Nations. I mean, shock. And now I wonder what's going to happen if First Nations make a concerted effort. Now, the recent decision of Jim Shot Both Sides has me pessimistic. Oh, my goodness. You're familiar with this decision where basically Alberta asserted a statute of limitations on treaty rights? I'm like, what? And the decision was penned by the new Indigenous Supreme. So it's just like, what are we to make of this? Anyway, gosh, you know, it's funny. Eh? Like we've had some big stuff happen. Like Manitoba just agreed to a $500 million settlement over the child special allowances that they withheld. Gosh, you know, what else is there to happen? But I think there could be, you just never know. You just never know, to be honest. We are kind of reactive that way on the podcast. Stuff emerges. But I was watching that Supreme Court case. We had talked about it in its lead up to the Supreme Court, and I'm still kind of digesting. We'll probably talk about that on the show.
You should.
But I mean, with the Wet'suwet'en pushback on the natural gas pipeline, I'm wondering where that's going to be. I mean, I think frankly, what I'm seeing and hearing in the United States, I think three states, Vox Media said they've effectively outlawed protest, and I wouldn't, you know, Alberta has already taken steps in that direction in terms of infrastructure, the Infrastructure Act, where, you know, they've really limited where people can protest and how. I see that as a trend that's only going to deepen and worsen frankly. And I don't know where the flashpoints are going to be.
Yeah, well.
So-called. I hate that term. I know that's a surveillance state term, but anyway.
No, I hear you. I think, although it's going to be hard to top in the world of Pretendians, Buffy St. Marie, I still think Pretendian outings, so to speak, for lack of a better phrase, will still probably be big from, you know, just hearing that there's more to come. There's more big names to come. So who knows? Okay. Well, Rick, I like to end this show with some advice for our younger viewers. And I get questions all the time by, I shouldn't say viewers, listeners, by Native youth, especially like the ones that are super organized in youth groups. And they've asked for advice for things like, hey, how can we start a podcast?
Well, interestingly timed question, because I just had an essay I contributed to a larger body of work published. The essay is entitled 333 Plus Podcast Episodes Later. Here's what I wished I knew. Here's what I wish I'd known up front. And
is that published?
Mm-hmm.
Where?
Well, if you go to my Twitter account, the Rick Harp, I think I've pinned it.
Okay. So there's good advice there then.
Well, indirect advice. So for example, I say among the biggest is that, you know, we think if we build it, create it, they will come. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. And I've watched from the sidelines how some folks doing content, I'd say on the same level as me, are getting a lot of attention relative to me. And so it's not a question of who's better or not, but they put the resources into what some call marketing or promotion.
Yes.
And if people don't know about you, then they can't enjoy what you do. And I think people underestimate that because they end up getting sucked into the thrills of making the content, but the content has to be, shared on all platforms, shared in various networks. Mm-hmm. It's so I almost feel like people need to be mindful of the allocation of effort. And so I think that there's one big lesson there. That, you know, I'm sort of in a bind because I've created this content of a certain type of a certain quality, and I wish I had other folks who were, because, you know, I'm doing this as a kind of an entrepreneurial effort, and so it really is me driving the bus, changing the tires, doing all the maintenance. Ideally, you'd have a co-pilot. Frankly, if you can find somebody else to embark upon something as insane as a podcast together with, that is a much better prospect. Now, on the other hand, if you're a control freak like me, that might be a challenge too, right? So it's tough, but there's more, as I quip, there's more to making media than media making. So you have to think about the wraparound needs of a media entity. There's lots of great content out there, I'm sure, that nobody knows about. And it's, well, how do you make sure people know about you? And, you know, there's lots of stuff out there. If you look, you know, Podcast Marketing 101, but that essay kind of, you know, there's a back end to creating a media entity, a property. I do all my own bookkeeping. I pretty much prep all my taxes and hand it over to an accountant. All this unglamorous stuff. Like people get into it thinking, yeah, I'm going to be on a mic. I'm going to be on camera. I'm going to look good. I'm going to sound good. And it's like, dude, like you've really got to think this through. And so, I mean, I'd like to see, frankly, an Indigenous podcast cooperative, you know, workers cooperative or something like that, where these kinds of things could be shared burdens. And, you know, one person could be the bookkeeper for all the podcasts or all that, all the myriad of administrative tasks that need doing. And I think, frankly, it's time we've had, you know, there's lots of podcast conferences. A lot of them are kind of like selling stuff, frankly, selling the dream. But then some of them really are just, you know, ground level peer-to-peer skills development. And I'd love to see an Indigenous podcast conference.
So if anybody listening thinks
the same way.
I can't wait, Rick. Rick is organizing an Indigenous podcast conference. I'm so excited, Rick. I can't
wait
to attend.
You heard it here first. This is a Pam News exclusive. Ding, 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 ding. I'm here with Rick Harp. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh. All those things that I think, gosh, if I had assistants, if I had editors, if I had writers, if I had producers, if I had, yeah, I hear you, Rick. Well, I mean, that's good, though. These are all things that will come about, right? You put it out into the universe, eventually it'll happen. But I want to thank you so much. And just before you go, I know I've said that 10 times now. Can you just talk a smidge about APTN News Brief? Because I want people to listen to it. I listen to it on my little Google Nest every day. Can you just give a little plug about
what that is? Yeah, about 2 or 3 years ago, I approached the then executive director, Karen Pugliese, who has since moved on to Canada Land, but we're now run by Cheryl McKenzie, who's just taking us into awesome new directions. And she saw the value of it. And so we continued to do it. It's basically, you know, a lot of people now get their news, if not exclusively, primarily through podcast form. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, well, you know, wouldn't it be great to leverage the content we put out on the television airwaves and bring it to people who live in the podcast, who live, breathe, and eat in the podcast space. And so basically it's a podcastified version of the top stories of the daily, or should I say nightly APTN newscast in audio only form. And so it's free. Anyone can just, you know, start following it on their favorite podcast player. It's roughly about 5 to 10 minutes every weekday. And you'll hear me present the news. So it's sort of like a blast from the past. And I'm the host producer of it. And I love it. I mean, I'm biased, but I know lots of people appreciate it. They appreciate having this alternate format, if you will, of the same rich content. I mean, there are an incredible number of stories that APTN News has broken that continue to be the number one source on. And if you are an audiophile and prefer your content that way, well, and want to know about the latest Indigenous headlines in Canada and beyond, what's your excuse for not having this in your saved shows?
Exactly. And I like it because it's short, it's sweet. I'm listening I wake up in the morning, here's the all of the updates on all the different things that I want to listen to. APTN is right there. I know it's happening in the Native community while I'm getting ready. So basically, Rick, I listen to your voice every day.
Well, my condolences. But nonetheless, the information is great. And I'm really tickled to be doing this. It's in some ways, it's a full circle thing, right? Because I did start as the host of the National Call-In Show, but then I pivoted into also co-anchoring the newscast, something I didn't mention before. So it's nice to have that touch point, but it's also neat to see. I mean, APTN was TV exclusive, right? The internet wasn't even really even in our peripheral vision until about 5 years into the mandate. So, and podcasting, forget it. So it nobody was talking about it because it didn't exist as a viable, feasible medium. And so here we are. I mean, it's a testament actually to like APTN's presence on YouTube, on TikTok and all the various platforms and now podcasting. I mean, and there's a whole fold of podcasts. There's about 5 or 6 podcasts that you can listen to from APTN. So if you didn't know, now you do, thanks to this PAM News exclusive.
That's right. I need to retitle my podcast, PAM News.
That's right. Love it.
Well,
love
Rick, thank you so much for taking the time to be on my podcast. It is now in history. I feel like I learn something new from you every time I hear you. And just personally, I appreciate, you know, the behind the scenes advice and guidance that you've provided to me whenever I've reached out, and over the years, the opportunities you've given to me, whether it's on ABTN or your podcast or anywhere else, to share my voice on Indigenous issues. And you've gone a long way in terms of helping, you know, Indigenous women have their voices on all of these platforms. I mean, it's huge in these largely male dominated areas. It's now changing, and in part thanks to you. So I really appreciate you, Rick.
Oh, well, I'm touched. I mean, it was definitely a priority for Media Indigena to have half the regular roster women. And mm-hmm. and who could... Yeah, Kim and Candace, incredible. Candace Collison, UBC professor. Kim Talbar, U of A professor. Oh, just dynamic duo. And along with Brock Bitawanaquat and Ken Williams, I could not be happier to have this stimulating stable of voices and intellects. It's quite something. And we're going to have you back on in some form or fashion, hopefully before the end of this season.
Maybe before the podcast conference?
Yeah, that's right. We'll do a live recording at this alleged conference that's coming.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Rick. And thanks to all the listeners for tuning into the show, for all the ways in which you should support the show, whether you're playing it in your classrooms, assigning it to your students, sharing it around, sharing on Patreon. Remember, at the end of the day, everyone who comes on my podcast is an Indigenous person involved in resistance, resurgence, revitalization, content creation, and there's a million ways you can support them. So check out Media Indigena, check out APTN News Brief, listen to Rick Harp every single day. And thanks again. Until next time, keep living a warrior life. Wulaliyah.